room at sundown, goes to the motel's payphone and dials the old number he has for the legendary Rover. After three rings, a deep French-accented voice says, "Hello? Amadou Beaumont." "How long's it been?" Beaumont asks when Jesse identifies himself.
20 years, Jesse replies.
Too long, Beaumont says. "To what do I owe the pleasure of hearing from you now?" Jesse is awkward on the telephone, has never gotten the hang of talking on it, so keeps the conversation short. He asks Beaumont if he knows of the fiends.
"The motorcycle gang," Beaumont says.
"I've heard the stories." Jesse tells him what happened in Phoenix and says he's calling in the hope he might have some ideas about how to handle the situation.
"This is serious business," Beaumont says. "I'll need to think on it. Where are you now?"
"Flagstaff," Jesse says.
"Come here, to Las Vegas. It's a good place to hide, and we can meet in person to discuss things."
"I'll call when we get there," Jesse says. "Thanks for trying to help."
"Thank Claudine," Beaumont says. "I'm only doing what she would have wanted."
Jesse hangs up and puts on the sunglasses Johanna gave him. He's feeling better. Not good, but better. Vegas is only 4 hours away, and at least they're running to something now, instead of away. Chapter 18.
"Jesse's changed the plan. We're going to Las Vegas to see Monsieur Beaumont instead of Denver. Do you recall Monsieur Beaumont?" Jesse asks me. "Monsieur Beaumont's a friend of mine. He likes to hear me sing. We visited him in New Orleans and in Las Vegas. He had a parrot that could speak French. He's going to help Jesse figure out what to do about the fiends. That's what Jesse tells Johanna when we're eating at Denny's."
"What about me?" Johanna says. Jesse says Monsieur Beaumont's going to try to help her too, so she should come with us.
"However things turn out," he says, "it'll be a shorter bus ride to L.A. for you." Johanna pretends to mull this, but I can see she's happy Jesse's keeping her around. Every time I look up, she's touching him, or he's touching her, and neither pays me any mind. I go to aping what they say. I do it louder and louder till Jesse tells me to leave off. "I ain't your sweetheart," I say. "I ain't the bad luck."
"Watch your mouth," Jesse says, and Johanna tells us to calm down.
We leave for Las Vegas. I ride shotgun with Abby on my lap and count broke down cars. Johanna asks Jesse to turn on the radio, and he does. "If it was me, he'd have said no. Wolfman Jack plays. Duke of Earl plays. Honeycomb plays. Maybe Baby by Buddy Holly."
Out of the blue, Johanna says,
"Why don't you let Edgar drive?" Jesse says, "I don't know about that." Johanna says, "There's hardly anybody on the road." She says, "You want to drive, don't you, Edgar?" She might be fooling, so I say, "It don't matter. Jesse won't let me."
"Sure he will," Johanna says.
"You're going to be careful," Jesse says. 10-4, good buddy," I say. We come to Kingman, and Jesse pulls into a filling station. He makes me check the oil. He makes me check the tires. Finally, he says, "She's all yours," and hands me the keys. I get in the driver's seat and start the engine. "Headlights on," I say, and pull the knob, brake off. I step on the clutch pedal, push the stick to 1, and ease onto the highway. I give it gas and push the stick to 2, then 3. "No faster than 60, Jesse says.
"Aye, aye, Captain," I say.
I drive all the way to Nevada and across the top of Hoover Dam. I go slow when I need to and fast when I need to. I keep the car between the lines even when it's narrow. Jesse has me turn into the parking lot of a casino by Lake Mead. He tells me and Johanna to wait while he goes inside. Johanna asks what he's doing. I tell her, "He's dipping."
"What's that?" she says.
"Lifting wallets," I say. "We need money."
"Oh," she says.
Jesse comes out and tells me move over, he's driving now. We skirt the lake and the stars look like they're floating in it. Then there's Las Vegas. We drive real slow down the strip. It's got lights in more colors than I know to name. They scamper like mice around signs and up the sides of buildings. Jesse puts the windows down and Johanna sticks her head out and howls like Wolfman Jack. Jesse stands by and lets me check us into the motel. I do it just right. He don't have to say nothing. When we get to the room, he turns his pockets out and his take from the casino spills on the bed. "Did you really steal that?" Johanna says.
"Who told you that?" Jesse says.
"I want it." Johanna knows he's lying, but she don't care. He counts the bills. "How much did you get?" Johanna says.
"Close to 200, Jesse says.
So can we go out and have some fun? Jehona says.
Just to eat, Jesse says. We gotta be careful.
I say hot dogs, and Jehona says pizza. Jesse says we'll get hot dogs tomorrow night. It's him and her against me.
The pizza place is full of noisy people. Jesse lets me play pinball and watch the man toss the dough. How I eat my slices, skin the cheese, and lick the sauce off the crust. Jesse and Jehona talk about Monsieur Beaumont. Jesse's meeting him tomorrow night. I told him about you, he says to Jehona. He wants me to bring you along. A boy at another table is staring. I make a scary face, but he don't quit. I stick out my tongue and he shoots me the finger. I ain't having that. I pick up a knife and say, you best watch yourself. I'll cut that fucking finger right off. His daddy wants to fight. Jesse pushes between us and says he's sorry, says I'm simple-minded. The boy's daddy says I ought not to be out if I don't know how to behave. Jesse tells me to get my ass to the car and keeps pushing me and saying how stupid I am. Jehona tries to cool him off. It's no big deal, she says. The kid was a brat. I stop walking and start crying. I ain't stupid. I ain't simple-minded. I'll beat you black and blue if you don't get a move on, Jesse says. That's no way for brothers to talk, Jehona says. We're standing by some slot machines. She holds out a handful of quarters. Feeling lucky, she says to me. Stop crying and you can have these. She lets me pick the game. Star Spangled Sevens. I put in a quarter and pull the handle. A red seven comes up, a white seven, and nothing. You gotta get three sevens to win anything. I put another quarter in, and another, and lose every time. I ain't lucky. I ain't never been lucky. I put my last quarter in and pull. Come on, Jehona says, big winner. A red, a white, and a blue seven. The game goes to whooping and quarters rain into the tray. I'm hooting and Jehona's hooting and even Jesse's got a smile. That's when darkness falls like a hood over my head, like when I seen the WAP in the mine. This time I see Jesse walking on a road as the sun rises. Walking and not worried about getting burned up. Quick as it came, the picture goes. I seen you in the desert, I say to Jesse. What are you talking about, he says. You remember the WAP, I say. I just seen you walking in the daytime. Jesse looks at me strange. You're having some kind of dream, he says. I know you gotta be sleeping to dream, but I let it lie. I scoop the quarters into a cup, and Jehona takes me to the money lady. She empties the cup into a counting machine, and it adds up to $10.25. I'm rich, I say, but $10 ain't rich. Jesse drops me and Jehona at the motel and goes out again. We look at TV and play cards till he gets back. He's been dipping again. Las Vegas is the best town for it. Everybody's got money and everybody's drunk. Jesse scored big and he's brought Jehona a green dress and me a plastic pirate sword. Jehona puts the dress on. It matches your eyes, Jesse says. She gives him a kiss. Don't even care. I'm watching. I poke Abby with the sword till she hisses. The sun's up when we go to bed. Jesse and Jehona keep me awake with their whispering and giggling. The circus man's hanging upside down above us, got a girl by the hands. He throws her to another man. All us watching go to clapping and whistling, and the circus folks drop into a net and take a bow. A fella comes out with a pack of dogs, one in a top hat, one in a dress. They commence to dancing on their hind legs, jumping through hoops and pushing a pram. I turn to tell Jesse we should get us a pup and catch him kissing Jehona. She's wearing the new dress. The little devil gives me a kick and says, I told you that bitch was trouble. When the dogs is done, the fancy man says, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that's our show for tonight. On behalf of Circus Circus and our performers, I bid you good evening and wish you the best of luck. I begged Jesse to bring me here, and he said okay, even though he's still worried about the fiend seeing us. They got games upstairs. The one where you knock over milk bottles, the one where you pop balloons, the one where you toss rope rings. They're all gaffed, but Jesse worked in a carnival, so knows the tricks. Put some backspin on it, he says, when I'm trying to throw baseballs into a peach basket, but the balls still bounce out. Jesse steps up and 1, 2, 3, makes all his shots. He tells the lady to give me the rubber lizard I was playing for. Jehona wants a stuffed bear. To get it, Jesse has to shoot a paper star with a machine gun. He does it his second try. Better an Al Capone, I say. We drive to Caesar's Palace. Monsieur Beaumont is waiting for us in a bar wearing a white suit.
He's got 6 scars across his forehead. I asked him once, did a lion get him over in Africa? He said the scars was a sign to show people what tribe he was in. I asked him, did his tribe live in teepees? And he said they got houses. He shakes my hand and says, it's been a long time, Monsieur Edgar. Do you still sing? I sure damn do, I say. Want to hear something? He says, maybe later. When he sees Jehona, his eyes get big, and he presses his palms together like he's praying. You were right, he says to Jesse. It's incredible. She's the very image of Claudine. He takes Jehona's hand and kisses her 3 times. It is a pleasure to meet you, my dear, he says. A lady is playing piano. Monsieur Beaumont pours some champagne for Jesse and Jehona, and Jesse says, I can have some too. I ain't never had champagne before. It's got bubbles and smells like sour milk. Jesse asks Monsieur Beaumont if he's got any ideas for what to do about the fiends. I've been asking around, Monsieur Beaumont says, and I may have found someone who can put me in touch with them. The first step is to see if they're willing to negotiate and perhaps accept some form of restitution in lieu of revenge. Will you do that for us? Jesse says. Monsieur Beaumont takes Jehona's hand again and says, how can I say no after seeing this beautiful creature? She mustn't come to any harm. Thank you, Jehona says. The piano lady is singing that song about Moon River. Monsieur Beaumont comes out of his swoon and says to Jesse, of course I can't guarantee anything. Stealing the infant, dusting one of their comrades, if it's even possible to arrange a settlement, the price will be steep. Whatever it takes, Jesse says. Monsieur Beaumont turns to me and Jehona and says, would you mind leaving us for a moment? We need to speak privately. Jehona looks to Jesse. Everything's fine, he says. Me and Jehona go to the casino. She gets 2 paper rolls of quarters, and we pick a couple slot machines. I put in 1/2 my quarters and don't win nothing. Then I get 3 oranges, and the game goes to flashing and making noise, but only a few coins come out. Jehona keeps looking over to the bar. I tell her, you gotta pay attention if you want to win. A girl showing lots of leg asks, do we want cocktails? I say to bring me a Coca-Cola with a cherry in it. My quarters is about gone by the time Jesse and Monsieur Beaumont come over. Monsieur Beaumont kisses Jehona again and says, farewell for now. I hope to see you again when there's time to become better acquainted. Why are you leaving so soon? I ask him. You didn't even hear me sing. Let's have a quick one, he says. How about meet me tonight in Dreamland? I start right in. Meet me tonight in Dreamland, under the silvery moon. Meet me tonight in Dreamland, where love's sweet roses bloom. He claps when I finish and says, bravo.
Chapter 19. June 29th, 1976, Las Vegas, Nevada. Time often slowed to a stagger this past year as I traced and retraced Benny's last steps, following the trail of postmarks on the cards he sent you. 5 minutes in Eureka could seem like an hour, an hour in San Francisco like 10 hours, a week in L.A. like an eternity. The past few days, however, have flown by, full of enough tribulation for a lifetime. I feel like a meteor hurtling toward Earth, falling faster and faster, growing hotter and hotter, about to explode. I woke an hour before dawn yesterday, bought a couple of hamburgers from the truck stop's restaurant, and took them to the kid in the camper. He wolfed the first sandwich down, drank from a jug of water, belched, and started on the second. What's your name, man? He asked me. My coffee was kicking in, so I played along. What's yours, man? Sal, the kid said. Cats call me Sally. Cats call me Charles. Cool, Sally said. His gold tooth flashed when he grinned. Charles, meet Sally. Sally, meet Charles. He finished the burger and licked his fingers. So, the old man's dead? He asked, in an offhand way, like he was trying to trick me into answering. He is, I replied. And I'm working for you now? I'll be using you the same as he did, I said. Well, you're already a better boss man, Sally said. I found rovers for him for 10 years, and he never told me his name or asked for mine. It was nothing but
Get out of the box and get in the truck.
Cross me and you'll wish he was still around, I said.
I know my place, Sally said.
He grimaced and rolled his head as if his neck hurt.
You mind if I stand and stretch?
I took Czarnecki's .45 from my pocket. Frail as the kid was, I wasn't too worried about him overpowering me, but I also wasn't taking any chances. He got to his feet, lifted his shackled arms as high as he could, and flexed his shackled legs.
I used to be hell on the dance floor, he said. Doubt I'd last one number now.
It was my first time conversing with a rover. I was curious. How old are you? I asked him.
I was born in 27 in Nowheresville, Iowa, but took off for New York as soon as I could, he said.
Is that where it happened? I said. Where you... I was unsure how to put it.
Where I became a creature of the night, Sally said, joking.
Yeah, that's where.
How?
I said. Why?
The old man has a jar of peanut butter there in the cupboard, Sally said. Let me at it, and I'll tell you what you want to know.
I took the jar down and gave it to him, along with the spoon I found in a drawer. He unscrewed the lid and dug in, scooping and licking while he talked. I met this cat in New York, he said. A colored cat like you, a trumpet player. His name was Daniel Carson, but everybody called him DC. We started making the scene together. It was just kicks at first, a good time, but we ended up real tight. I knew he was a rover, but I didn't care. I thought it was kind of cool, kind of sexy. I even let him feed off me. Got off on it, in fact. It was my idea he turned me. We had a good thing, and I wanted to keep it going. And it was good for almost 8 years. We bummed around, played gigs, got in trouble, got out of trouble, wore $500 suits, $300 shoes. It was a real gas. But then he got dusted. He paused, overcome by emotion. When he tried to go on, he couldn't. I'm done, he said. He handed me the peanut butter jar and lay back in the crate. You're not going to hold me being queer against me, are you? He asked. I was thinking of Benny. You know I was. No, I said. I won't hold it against you. I closed the lid and snapped the locks into place. As I was leaving the camper, stepping out into the new day blooming, he called to me again.
Where are we headed?
I haven't decided, I said.
Vegas, he said. If you're looking for rovers, that's where you should go.
The rising sun set the mountains on fire. I stood in the parking lot, marveling at the sight and wondering if it was a message from God, and if so, what it meant. I came up with nothing, which proves, I guess, that I don't have the imagination to be a prophet, so it's a good thing I've been called to be a killer. Taking the kid's advice, I set off across the desert. 6 hours of sand, rock, and sun, of ruler-straight stretches of shimmering asphalt, and mountains as sharp and menacing as wolves' teeth. I stopped in Death Valley to top off the radiator and buy a cold drink. A thermometer at the service station read 116 degrees. I had to squint in the glare, and the soles of my shoes stuck to the blacktop. I took a bag of ice and a bottle of water out to Sally. Czarnecki would have said, "Fuck him." But I wanted the kid in decent shape, ready to hunt. There inside the camper was so hot, it was hard to breathe. Sally was gasping when I opened the crate. He guzzled the water and laid the ice on his chest.
"You're a good man," he said.
"I'd do the same for a dog," I replied and locked him up again. It was too hot to sleep in the truck once we got to Vegas, so I splurged on a motel just off the strip. I closed the drapes, turned up the air conditioner, and took a cold shower. Lying on the bed afterward, I was snoring before my body dried. I woke at dusk. Next to the phone was a menu for a Chinese restaurant that delivered.
I called and ordered the works, the Emperor's Feast for two. The food arrived, and when I'd had my fill, I decided to bring Sally in to eat his share, rather than carrying everything out to him. The sun was down, but it was still stifling in the camper. I unlocked the crate and said, "You can come inside for a while, but if you so much as twitch in a way that spooks me, I'll kill you."
"You got my word, boss," Sally said.
I covered him with the .45 as he climbed out of the box. I'd backed the truck into the space in front of the room, so all he had to do was cross the walkway. He sat at the table in his chains and ate out of the cartons. I sat on the bed, keeping the gun on him. He used chopsticks at first, but changed to a fork. Said his fingers weren't working right. When he asked if I'd turn on the TV, I couldn't think of a reason not to. He finished his dinner watching a cop show and wanted to take a shower. I could smell him from across the room, so I tossed him the keys so he could undress. Though I'd seen him without clothes in Zernecki's shed, he seemed even more pitiful now, skin stretched over bulging bones, muscles wasted away, toothpick legs. The butterfly tattoo on his chest and gold tooth were like diamond earrings and a tiara on a corpse. I let him bathe without cuffs. There was no danger of him slipping out through the tiny window in the bathroom. He was steadier on his feet afterward, stood a little straighter. I gave him a t-shirt and a pair of pants from my duffel. They hung on him like he was a scarecrow, but at least they were clean. Then I told him to get back into his chains. We were going hunting. He locked himself in next to me in the truck, and we drove up and down the strip. When we passed the sands, I recalled when you and I stayed there. That was a good time. We saw Red Fox and Wayne Newton, laid out by the pool and ate steak and lobster two dinners in a row. I'll have different kind of memories after this visit, terrible ones. That's how it is now. Everything good in my past is being swallowed by a rising tide of horror. After an hour with no sign of a rover, I switched to Fremont Street downtown. Remember how it is there? Casinos crammed together, cheek by jowl, tourists overflowing the sidewalks. You said the lights and noise hypnotized them into throwing away their money. Sally and I crawled past the crowds with our windows down, and it was like bees buzzing in a sparkling hive. The kid had been quiet since we left the motel. Zernecki accused him of playing games, of not pointing out rovers when he spotted them, and I wondered if he might be doing me the same way. A block later, though, he whistled and said, "Bingo!" It was a white woman, tall, skinny, blonde hair piled on top of her head. She looked to be in her 30s and was wearing a short dress and the kind of high heels meant to attract attention. I kept pace with her as she bopped down the sidewalk, but then she ducked into the Golden Nugget. "Are you sure?" I asked Sally.
"I'm sure," he said.
I found a spot on the second floor of a parking garage, and as soon as the coast was clear, hustled Sally into his crate. My heart was pounding as I ran down the stairs and through the back entrance of the casino. The place was packed with gamblers hovering over blackjack tables and slouched in front of slots. A celebration broke out at a craps game, clapping and whistling and shouts of "Attaboy" and "Keep 'em coming," and waitresses dressed like Old West saloon girls chanted, "Cocktails, cocktails." I squinted through the cigarette smoke for the blonde, found her posing at the bar. The bartender set a drink in front of her, and she reached for her purse, but the guy sitting beside her, a balding, paunchy white man in a cheap suit, laid a hand on her arm. "Pretty ladies drink for free when Mark Arcamonte is around," he said. He and the woman began to flirt. I sat at a nearby slot machine and eavesdropped on the man's life story, or at least the version he told women he met in bars. Illinois, insurance, top salesman, only the best for him. He took out his wallet and showed the blonde photos of his car and his boat. When he flipped to a picture of his kids, he kept his thumb over the face of his ex-wife,
who was also in the shot. "You don't want to look at her," he said. "You'll turn to stone." The blonde laughed when she was supposed to, offered sympathy when Argamonte asked for it, and thanked him for the free drinks with cheek kisses and cuddles. Finally, though, it was time to close the deal. "This has been fun and all, but, you know, I'm on the clock, right?" she said. "Sure, sure, I get that," Argamonte replied. "So what now?"
"Let's get the hell out of here."
I tailed them as they walked out of the casino and east on Fremont. The crowds disappeared after a few blocks, casinos giving way to liquor stores, pawn shops, and budget motels. The blonde and Arcamonte turned into the parking lot of a low-slung dump called the Sky Harbor Inn. I caught up in time to see them step into room 104 on the ground floor. It hit me that Argamonte might be the blonde's next victim instead of a customer. I crossed the street, sat on the curb, and pictured her talking dirty to him, nuzzling his ear, then pulling a knife to cut his throat. God was kind to the man, however. An hour after he went into the room with the blonde, he left alone and slunk back toward Glitter Gulch. 15 minutes later, the blonde came out. She walked two doors down to room 106 and used the key to let herself in. It was 2 a.m. I kept watch until 5, but she never reappeared. I was wide awake as day broke, buzzing with nervous energy. Knowing the blonde would have to stay put, I hurried back to the truck and grabbed Czarnecki's duffel bag, the one he carried into the Mexican's room in Reno. It held everything I'd need. Then it was back to the motel. Fremont was deserted now, except for one crazy drunk shadowboxing in the window of a casino. The slot parlor's recorded spiels echoed down the empty street, and daylight dimmed the neon to almost nothing. Nobody was stirring at the Sky Harbor either. My chest was tight as I approached room 106. My hands shook when I took the crowbar from the bag and wedged it into place, and I was going on pure instinct when I forced the door open. The blonde, wearing only a bathrobe, flew at me from the bed. She went for my eyes, but I backed her off with the crowbar. Her skin smoked when she stumbled into the sunlight streaming through the doorway. She kicked the door shut and charged again. I swung the crowbar and caught her in the head. Blonde wig askew, she fell onto the bed, bleeding from a gash on her scalp. I pulled out the ice pick I'd slipped into the pocket of my coat and dove at her. As I straddled her, ready to stab her in the heart, a child's voice rang out, "Mommy?" I glanced over to see a girl of 7 or so, dressed in Raggedy Ann pajamas, cowering near the bathroom. My pause gave the blonde time to recover. She bucked me off, and we wrestled for the pick. "Please don't kill my daughter," she said. This was something I hadn't planned on, something I hadn't even imagined. "Do what you want to me, but don't kill her." I got on top of her again and drew back the pick. The child was crying now. The blonde lifted her hands, fingers laced together. "Please," she said, then punched me in the nose with both fists. Blinded by pain, I stabbed wildly. The child jumped onto the bed and grabbed me around the throat from behind. She bit my ear, digging her teeth in and shaking her head until I fell back on top of her. "Kill him!" she yelled. The blonde came up with a knife, rolled over, and brought the blade down. I blocked her arm and stuck the ice pick in her neck. Blood spraying out of her mouth spattered my face. I yanked the pick free and jammed it into her chest. She stopped coughing and went limp. I pried the child's fingers from my throat, bending them until some broke, then picked her up and flung her across the room. She bounced off the wall and lay moaning on the floor. I grabbed the crowbar. "You motherfucker!" the kid hissed. "You piece of shit!" I brought the bar down on her head. That shut her up. I didn't bother carrying the bodies into the bathroom. I used the hacksaw to turn them to ash where they lay. The blonde on the bed, the child on the floor. After catching my breath, I put the ice pick and crowbar in the bag and took a winding route, side streets and alleys, back to the truck, stopping often to make sure nobody was following. I didn't notice I had blood on my hands until I pulled into the parking lot of my motel. Even though I was in the blonde's room for less than 5 minutes, I feel like I was transformed there, like I burst and shed my old skin. What I fear is that I'm now more akin to one of the monsters than to a man, and farther away from home than ever. Pray for me. June 30th, 1976, Las Vegas. I took water to Sally in the hottest part of the day yesterday and brought him in to finish the Chinese food when the sun went down. He looked even steadier and more clear-eyed, and I thought of Czernecki's warning about keeping him weak. "Did you get the woman?" he asked as he broke open a fortune cookie. "None of your business," I replied. "You don't seem too happy about it," he said. "The old man, shit, he'd celebrate afterward, get drunk, fry up a steak, play his cowboy records. You look like someone kicked you in the balls." "I don't take joy in killing, even if it's monsters," I said. "So you're in the wrong line of work then," Sally said. "You want my advice? If it doesn't sit right with you, don't do it. Walk away. Cut me loose and walk away." "I've got a score to settle." The kid picked up a chopstick and sighted down it like you would a pool cue to check if it was bowed. "A rover took someone you knew," he said. "My son," I said. I've grown so used to talking about Benny's death with strangers that it slipped out before I could stop it. "And how many rovers are you going to have to kill to get even?" Sally said. I wasn't in the mood for a philosophical discussion, especially not with someone who'd say anything to regain his freedom. "Shut your mouth or it's back in the box," I said. "I wasn't trying to upset you." "Shut your mouth," I said again, this time acting like I was about to get up and do him harm. "It's cool," Sally said. "Everything's cool." He turned to watch television. A news program was on, something about preparations for the 4th around the country. I stared at the set, too, thinking about Sally's question regarding getting even. I wondered at what point the thirst for vengeance becomes a sin of pride. I remember God's warning against lashing out at those who've wronged you. Him saying, "It is mine to avenge. I will repay." And then I questioned whether all that wasn't just me looking for an excuse to cut and run after getting a real taste of what my life will be like if I take up Czernecki's crusade. After a while, Sally said, "What's going on in Vietnam?" "What do you mean?" I said. "I've been in a hole for 10 years, man. I don't know anything." "The war's over," I said. "They say we lost." "How about the Yankees? How are they doing?" "Looking good this year. Might go all the way." "Who's dead? Who's alive? Louis Armstrong?" "He's dead," I said. "Coltrane? Dead. I bet fucking Sinatra's still kicking, though. Fucking Bing Crosby. Both alive," I said. "Figures." Sally quieted down again, then said, "I've got a score to settle, too." "With who?" I said. "DC. My pal," Sally said. "You know who dusted him?" "Rovers. 3 nigger-hating rovers." He started to fidget. "We were in Memphis," he continued. "Him and this kid were walking back to our hotel from Beale Street, where he was playing. And these rednecks jumped them. They said they didn't need another rover in Memphis, especially not a black one, and tied DC and the kid up and drove them out to the sticks. The kid got away, but hid close by and came to me later and told me what happened. He said the Hicks beat DC until all his bones were broken. He said one of them blew on DC's horn while the others took turns stabbing him. After that, they put a noose around his neck and threw him off a bridge. Dumb as they were, they didn't think about the drop when the rope snapped taut.
It tore DC's head right off. He was dust before his shoes hit the river. Sally bent double in the chair and went silent for a while, then suddenly sat up and said, "I love that man. I still can't think about what happened to him without wanting to die myself." "I loved my son," I said. "So you understand," Sally said. "You understand that even though being locked up in that shed has been hell, I figure at least I've gotten a little payback for DC by leading the old man to Rovers." I was tired of listening to him, tired of having to think about things from his point of view. What I needed was clarity, not someone muddying the water even more. He stacked the empty takeout boxes, one inside the other. "What if I gave you someone special?" he said. "What's that mean?" I said. "A special Rover. One more important than the rest, one who's like royalty to them. A Rover who could lead you to 100 others. If I gave you someone like that, could we make a deal?" "A deal?" I said. "I take you to this cat and you let me go." "No way," I said. "I didn't kill your son. You killed someone's." Sally drummed his fingers on the table. "How about this then?" he said. "How about you catch this cat, put him in the box, and dust me?"
Chapter 20. None of the fiends sleep well after Bob One is dusted. Pedro and Johnny toss and turn and jump at every little sound. Yuma and Real Deal argue over nothing. Bob Two smokes a joint, drinks a bottle of whiskey, and stares at the TV, trying to ignore the empty bed beside him as the day drags on, never ending. When night finally smothers the sun and makes the world safe for her bastards, the gang emerge from their rooms and gather by the pool. Antonia and Elijah bring everyone foam cups of lobby coffee, and Pedro passes a pint of VO to sweeten it. They drink a toast to the dead Bob and get down to business. Antonia has a map of Phoenix. She's divided it into three sections. She and Elijah will take one, Real Deal and Yuma another, Bob and Johnny and Pedro the third. They'll crisscross the city searching for the pair who dusted Bob and stole the baby. It was a young man and an old one, but Antonia tells them to grab anyone turned and put the screws to them. Bob's not happy with the section he and Pedro and Johnny have been assigned. It's mostly sleepy housing tracts and farmland that'll soon be sleepy housing tracts. No dive bars, no horse strolls, no strip clubs or dirty bookstores. Nowhere they're likely to find a Rover on the hunt. Hopped up on bathtub crank, he's riding bitch behind Pedro. They pull over and check a miniature golf course, walk through a supermarket, and sit in front of a movie theater as the show lets out. Nothing but clean-cut squares and their clean-cut wives and kids. Eventually, they come upon a discotheque glowing pink and purple at the edge of civilization. Next to it is a freshly uprooted orchard with a sign planted on it that reads, "Future Site of Sunset Estates, Affordable Luxury." The disco is no massage parlor or dime a dance cantina, but the parking lot is full, so they decide to have a look inside. Two men guard the door. One is wearing a denim suit and a white polyester shirt unbuttoned to display the gold chains around his neck. The other is a big Indian bruiser in a tank top and tight jeans. "Oh," Johnny says to the Indian. It's the only kickaboo he knows. "Hello." The Indian ignores him. Gold chain says there's a $5 charge to get into the club. "What do you get for that?" Johnny asks. "A titty show?" The flashing lights make the gold chain guy's mustache look like it's bouncing on his upper lip. "This ain't that kind of place, if that's the kind of place you're looking for," he says. Nah, Johnny says. "This is the kind of place we want." "You sure?" "There's chicks in there, right? Music, beer. You dudes looking to dance?" "Hell yeah," Johnny says. "We're dancing fools." The music punches the fiends in the chest when they step inside, the bass hitting like a steady jab. Swiveling lights sink to the beat, disorient them, and the club is as hot and humid as a Florida swamp. They muscle their way through the crowd to the bar, a black schooner parting a churning sea. Johnny orders for them, three beers. The girl behind the bar frowns at the grubby five he drops as payment. She straightens the bill gingerly, using her long red fingernails, puts it in the till, and walks away. The fiends find a wall to lean against. They sip their beers and watch the action on the dance floor. Everyone spins and claps in unison, the men shaking their asses as much as the women.
"I knew a pimp who had a get-up like that," Johnny shouts in Pedro's ear, pointing at one of the dancing men.
After half an hour, the music and lights have given Bob a headache. He feels like he's trapped on a carnival ride. He's about to tell Johnny and Pedro, "Let's get the fuck out of here," when a tall, thin dude, surrounded by a black aura, enters the club with an unturned chick on his arm. He's not one of the rovers that dusted Bob too, but beggars can't be choosers. The fiends duck into the hallway leading to the bathrooms to avoid being spotted. Bob peeks around the corner to watch the rover and the chick dance their way to the bar. He and the others make their move while the guy's flagging down a bartender, surrounding him. He starts to bitch about being crowded, but freezes when he sees his rovers.
"What's your name, brother?"
Bob says.
"Darren,"
the rover replies. He's wearing white pants and a lime green shirt.
"We need to talk to you, Darren."
The rover looks from Bob to Johnny to Pedro, contemplating running. Bob wraps an arm around him.
"Order me a scotch and soda," Darren tells the girl, a little blonde in a sequin dress that barely covers her ass. "I'll be right back."
The fiends hustle him to the door and walk him out to the future site of Sunset Estates. Bob releases him when they're beyond the reach of the disco's lights. Darren straightens his clothes and smooths his hair. Figures cockies how he'll play this.
"Fiends," he says, "I've heard of you."
"We haven't heard of you," Bob says.
"I'm a city mouse. New York, Philly, Boston, and I keep to myself."
"What are you doing here, city mouse?"
"I'm on my way to San Diego to see a pal."
"And the chick?"
"Some local chippy."
Darren takes some double mint out of his pocket, pulls a stick for himself, and holds the pack out to the fiends. Johnny pinches a piece.
"How long you been in town?" Bob says.
Darren unwraps the gum and sticks it in his mouth.
"This is my third night. Seen any other rovers?"
"Nope."
"You sure? Nobody's traveling with you?"
"I told you, I keep to myself." The fiends exchange heavy glances.
"You said you heard of us," Bob says.
"This and that," Darren says.
"Like what?"
"Like steer clear of you."
"Good advice."
Pedro has slipped behind Darren. He slaps a hand over his mouth, and Bob stabs him in the heart. They've dusted him 10 seconds after he hits the ground. Johnny paws through the ash, retrieving the guy's wallet and puka shell necklace.
"We going back in?"
he says.
"Fuck it," Bob says. "Let's see what other shitholes we can find."
Antonia and Elijah have passed through Phoenix once or twice a year since before Arizona was a state. The first time they visited, they rode in on horseback. They've watched the city grow from a dusty cluster of saloons, dance halls, and assay offices into a sprawl of suburbs that's filled the valley with shopping malls, golf courses, and housing developments. And now the powers that be are pulling down old Phoenix. Every time Antonia and Elijah return, more downtown landmarks have been demolished and replaced with smoked glass and concrete high-rises. The Fox Theater is now a bus terminal. The cheap hotel where they used to stay is a gleaming Hyatt, and their favorite chop suey joint lies buried beneath a new convention center. The area used to be prime hunting ground, the whores working the Paris Alley brothels, the sots pickling themselves in the dives lining the streets of the Deuce, and the assorted other lost souls who haunted the gambling dens, topless grinds, and all-night movie theaters. Ragged men and women still drink, fight, and fuck here. But now it's right out in the open, and when they crash, it's not in dollar flops or cots at the Mission. It's on the sidewalk, curled in cardboard boxes in the shadow of the new buildings. Elijah laments the changes, but Antonia couldn't care less. Nostalgia's a weakness, as far as she's concerned. When something's gone, it's gone. Cut it loose and move on. She's lost so much in her 200 years, she'd drown in tears if she mourned it all. They're cruising the same streets for the third time. It's close to midnight, and nobody's out. Elijah taps his horn to get Antonia's attention and points to the Torch, a bar they know. They circle the block and park in front of the place.
"Let's grab a quick one," Elijah says. "Might be our last chance."
Antonia's reluctant. 3 years ago, she fed off an old man she picked up here.
"I don't got a person who gives a shit about me," he told her. "Everyone I know is dead."
She lured him to an abandoned produce warehouse on the promise of a handjob, drained him, and got rid of the corpse in the desert. Nobody'll remember you, Elijah says. They won't even remember him. They step over a kid passed out on the sidewalk to enter the bar. His girlfriend is messed up too, sitting on the curb and chanting, "Greg! Greg! Greg!" The bar is bright as day inside. Four gargoyles are hunched over the stick, a few more in the booths. Something by the doors wheezes out of the jukebox. The bartender is a leathery, red-headed woman wearing a cardboard red, white, and blue top hat. More star-spangled crap is hanging on the walls in anticipation of the fourth. The woman takes Elijah's order for two draft A1s and says, "Those junkies still out front?" "They are," Elijah says. "Call the fucking police, Sarah, will you?" one of the gargoyles croaks. "I don't need Phoenix PD in here," the bartender says. "I should go out there and shoot him myself." "You ain't gonna shoot nobody," the bartender says, rolling her eyes at Antonia and Elijah. "He ain't even got a gun," she says out of the side of her mouth. The junkies are still on the sidewalk when the fiends leave. Elijah doesn't feel like getting back on his bike yet. There's a porno theater next to the bar. 3XX features. "You want to see a movie?" he asks Antonia. "If you need to get your ashes hauled, we'll go to the motel," she says. "Come on, we'll watch until the bars close." They pay their admission to a zitty kid behind the candy counter. The only snacks for sale are warm sodas and stale popcorn. Elijah gooses Antonia while they wait at the back of the theater for their eyes to adjust. "Don't you touch me," she says. Someone's fucking someone on screen. The moans aren't synced to the action, and the print is so bad it's like watching a catfish flap its gills through the glass of a filthy aquarium, rhythmic flailing in greenish murk. They sit as far from the other patrons as possible, but even so, one of the sewer rats pops up to leer at Antonia. A hard look from Elijah sends him back into his hole. Elijah tries to follow the movie, but there's not much story to keep track of. Squinting at the screen, he wonders if this is what it's like to be a ghost, if after you die you're doomed to peer from the dark into the light, the living world just out of focus, a smear of writhing bodies, speeding cars, and ringing telephones. He leans over to whisper this thought to Antonia, but she's fast asleep. The fiends reconvene by the pool near dawn. "Nothing?" Antonia says.
"We drove our section 5 times, Real Deal says.
"We got something," Bob says, and tells everybody about Darren. "Maybe the next one we find will know something about those that dusted Bob."
"And maybe not," Real Deal says. "Maybe they've already hit the road. Maybe we ought to hit the road, too."
Bob bristles. "We're not giving up," he says. "Not after one fucking night."
"I'm not talking about giving up," Real Deal says. "I'm talking about looking for them someplace else."
Antonia just wants to get to bed. "We'll go out again tomorrow," she says. "Switch routes and put fresh eyes on everything."
"However you want to do it," Bob says, "but we're not giving up."
Johnny hands him a can of beer. He presses it to the back of his neck, trying to cool off. After another restless day, the fiends set out for a second night of searching. Bob rides with Pedro and Johnny again. They're covering downtown this evening. Lots more people on the street, lots more places you might find a rover. They take a break at a hamburger stand. An old alky trying to place an order at the window can't keep his pants up. They're too big for him, probably pulled out of a trash can. But he keeps forgetting and letting go of the belt loops, whereupon the trousers drop to his ankles, exposing his skinny legs and bare ass until he squats to yank them up again.
"Be a good boy and give your dad your belt," Bob says to Johnny.
"He looks like a jack-in-the-box, don't he?"
Johnny says.
He kicks Pedro, who's crouched next to his bike.
"What do you think? Is he just a weenie wagger putting on a show?"
Pedro doesn't respond. His head is down and he's gasping for air. Johnny kneels beside him.
"What's wrong?"
Pedro wipes away a strand of drool and swallows hard.
"Help me up," he says.
Johnny and Bob walk him around the parking lot until he's breathing normally and able to stand on his own.
"I've gone too long without feeding," he says. "It snuck up on me."
"How bad are you?" Johnny says.
"I'm gonna have to hunt tonight."
"So we're calling off the search?" Bob says, anger in his voice.
"I'll be fine on my own," Pedro says. "You two keep looking."
He gets on his bike and starts it.
I'll catch you back at the motel, he says, before riding off.
Cuidado,
Johnny calls after him. Real Deal and Yuma start by riding every street in their sector twice. The problem is nobody walks in this town, so pretty much their only hope of spotting a rover without getting off their bikes and going into every goddamn place is to catch one entering or exiting a bar or 7-Eleven. And what are the odds of that? Yuma signals Real Deal to turn into the parking lot of a strip mall with a 24-hour laundromat. The place is empty, and all the other businesses in the mall are closed for the night.
You see something? Real Deal says.
I'm bored, Yuma says.
She steps off her Harley and pulls a screwdriver out of one of her saddlebags. Walking into the laundromat, she goes to the soap vending machine, uses the screwdriver to bust the lock, and pockets the money she finds there.
Feel better, Real Deal says when she comes out and gets on her bike.
Still bored, she says.
The two of them have been together for 9 years. They met in Dallas and fell in love fast and hard. She's on and off crazy, so is he, and they accept this in each other. So far, whenever she's lost it, he's been right enough in the head to stop her from getting in too much trouble, and she's done the same for him. Riding with the fiends for the past 5 years has helped, too. The discipline imposed by Antonia keeps them on track most of the time. Real Deal's not sure what flipped Yuma's switch tonight. Bob getting dusted, the other Bob acting like an asshole, losing out on the baby. But he knows he's got his hands full. Her next stop is a closed gas station. He waits while she jimmies the Coke machine. A few minutes later, she tries to smash her way into a parking meter with a hammer.
If you need money, all you gotta do is ask, Real Deal says, joking.
I don't need your fucking money, she replies.
She gets back on her bike and rides until she comes to a liquor store in a Mexican neighborhood. Real Deal follows her into the parking lot and turns off his engine when she does. Three men leaving a bar next to the store stop to admire her Harley.
How much you pay? One of them asks her.
$1 million, she says. $2 million.
The guy makes a face and repeats what she said in Spanish to his buddies. They scoff too.
No, $2 million, the guy says to her. $2 million pesos.
His buddies laugh, and all three climb into a pickup bristling with gardening tools and drive away. Real Deal runs a hand over his closely cropped afro. It comes away sweaty.
What are you up to now? He says.
Yuma walks into the store without answering. He follows. An old Mexican couple is behind the counter. The wife's sitting on a milk crate, watching a soap opera on a tiny TV. The husband's at the register, a cigar stub wedged in the corner of his mouth. The store shelves are overflowing with merchandise. The place sells groceries in addition to booze, cans of beans and hominy and menudo, sacks of rice, wilted vegetables, and also odds and ends like toilet plungers and tamale pots. Dramatic music plays on the TV as Yuma goes to the beer cooler without so much as a nod to the old man. Real Deal tries to be friendly, saying, Buenas noches, and pretending to be interested in a display of car deodorizers, pine trees, Playboy bunnies, Mexican flags. The old man ignores him. He's watching Yuma in a round mirror mounted on the ceiling. Yuma grabs a six-pack of Coors Tall Boys and lets the cooler door slam. She asks the old man for a pint of Cuervo. When he turns to get it off one of the shelves behind him, she shoves a fistful of Slim Jims into the pocket of her jacket. The old man sets the bottle on the counter and rings it up. His wife's standing now, too, staring at Yuma. Yuma grabs the beer and tequila and walks out without paying. Hey! The old man shouts, all of a sudden holding a pistol. The old woman has a machete in her hand.
It's cool, Real Deal says. I got it.
He lays a 20 on the counter and backs out of the store. Yuma cracks one of the beers in the parking lot and downs half of it. Real Deal finishes it while she loads the rest of the stuff into one of her saddlebags. She throws her leg over her bike and starts it. Real Deal puts his hand on hers to stop her from revving the engine. She glares at him, something wild thrashing behind her eyes.
You see me, right? He says. I'm here for you.
But you weren't always, she says.
She puts her bike in gear and takes off. Pedro keeps a string of boxcars between him and the hobo jungle at the edge of the train yard. The track bed is elevated enough that if he crouches, he can see under the cars to the camp beyond. He makes his way toward it stealthily, avoiding the noisy crushed rock ballast covering the embankment. The jungle is nestled in a grove of willows. A small fire flickers there, and Pedro hears someone speaking Spanish. He climbs on top of a car and lies on his stomach, giving him a clear view of four men gathered around scrap wood burning in a ring of stones. They're Indios, like the ones who did all the shit work in Huamantla, the town in Mexico where he grew up. Short, stocky, and dark. Two of them are playing cards on an apple crate. The other two are lying on the ground, staring at the flames. A gallon of gallo is making the rounds. The men in these camps are wanderers and vagrants, runaways and fugitives. The kind of men who disappear. The kind of men nobody misses. Pedro's knee trembles. He'll be feeding tonight. He's sure of it.
I was in a game in Salinas once. A guy bet his truck.
I was in a game where a guy bet his house, and I won it.
You never won anything in your life.
A woman carrying a baby gets on a bus.
No jokes! No jokes!
Pass me the bottle. It's empty.
The Indios are drunk. Pedro can hear it in their voices. He reaches into his pocket for his knife. A train blows its horn somewhere behind him.
Go for another. The market's closed. It's open till midnight. Pendejos.
One of the card players staggers up the path leading from the jungle to the rail yard. Pedro drops from the top of the boxcar. The only light comes from a few weak bulbs mounted on poles widely spaced around the yard. The Indio crosses two sets of tracks and approaches the string Pedro is hiding behind. Three cars up from his, the man crawls under the train, emerging on the same side as Pedro. Pedro lies flat on the ground, but the Indio is focused on his mission. He sets off across the yard toward a road leading to a small store. Pedro follows, closing the distance between them. Another string of cars blocks their way. When the Indio ducks to pass beneath it, Pedro scrambles under the car right on his heels. He grabs the man's arm, flips him onto his back, and presses a hand to his mouth. Lying on top of him, he uses the tip of his knife to poke a hole in his jugular. The Indio struggles, but there's no chance of him squirming out from under Pedro's bulk. Pedro fixes his lips to his neck. He smells cheap wine. The man eventually settles, and Pedro repositions him to keep the blood flowing. When the well runs dry, he keeps sucking, enjoying the warmth creeping through his body and the calm enveloping his brain after days of feeling antsy. The yard bull plays his flashlight over a string of cars a couple of tracks away. Pedro waits until he's gone before dragging the Indio's body from under the car and slinging it over his shoulder. He carries it to the other side of the yard, where another trail leads to a reservoir ringed by cottonwoods. Once at the reservoir, he lays the body next to the water and removes its clothes. By the light of a fingernail moon, he cuts open the belly of the corpse and scoops out the innards, tossing them into tall grass. Coyotes will eat them before dawn. The buzzing of a million cicadas in his ears, he gathers the biggest rocks he can find and fills the Indio's stomach cavity with them. The water is warm as he walks out into the reservoir, towing the corpse behind him. The muddy bottom slopes quickly downward, and he lifts the body to keep it from sinking, carries it in his arms. When the water reaches his chin, he pushes off and keeps going, swimming now, kicking hard while burying the dead man. In the middle of the reservoir, he lets the body drag him down. When his toes touch mud, he looks up toward the tarnished silver shimmer of the surface. The water is 10 feet deep here, deep enough nobody will ever find the Indio. He releases the corpse. It sinks to the bottom, and he rockets back to the surface and swims to shore. Back on the bank, Pedro dresses and turns for a last look at the reservoir. The water is calm again, faintly reflecting the moon, the stars, and the overarching trees. It's not so bad. There are worse spots the Indio could have ended up. The fireworks stand, a trailer parked in an empty lot, is locked up for the night. Yuma and Real Deal park across the road. Yuma fetches her screwdriver, and Real Deal doesn't bother to tell her what a stupid idea this is. She's drunk now, which only makes her more stubborn.